If you've been told to pull up your socks, then make sure it's a pair of TNT socks. The TNT shop is now open at TNTRadio.live. Mark Morano is unleashed, and he's taking on the World Economic Forum, the World Health Organization, and the United Nations on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. All right. We've heard him on this show before. He's one of the, I guess, as George W. Bush would say, one of the evildoers in the world. Yuval Noah Harari, key advisor to Klaus Schwab of the World Economic Forum. He's a World Economic Forum agenda contributor. He recently talked about how human rights are just a fictional story. It's a fable. And I think he even compared it to the fable of religion. That gives you an idea where these people are coming from. This is World Economic Forum agenda contributor Yuval Noah Harari. Clip one.
Most legal systems are based on this idea, this belief in human rights. But human rights are just like heaven and like God. It's just a fictional story that we've invented and spread around. It may be a very nice story. It may be a very attractive story. We want to believe it. But it's just a story. It's not a reality. It is not a biological reality. Just as jellyfish and woodpeckers and ostriches have no rights, Homo sapiens have no rights also. Take a human, cut him open, look inside, you find their blood, and you find the heart and lungs and kidneys, but you don't find there any rights. The only place you find rights is in the fictional stories that humans have invented and spread around. And the same thing is also true in the political field. States and nations are also like human rights and like God and like heaven. They too are just stories. A mountain is a reality. You can see it, you can touch it, you can even smell it. But Israel or the United States, they are just stories, very powerful stories, stories we might want to believe very much, but still they are just stories. You can't really see the United States. You cannot touch it. You cannot smell it.
You see what's happening here? Because he says you can't see religion, he says, you can't see our rights, that they're just stories, they're fables. What does that mean? This is one of the most powerful advisors, the World Economic Forum, home to respect, support, and attendance by presidents, prime ministers, millionaires, billionaires, corporations, academia, royal family, celebrities, bureaucrats, government officials at all levels. They train government officials. This is the message of the top advisor to Klaus Schwab of the World Economic Forum, that these are fables. This is laying the groundwork. Now, he's a very intellectual person. You could read his books. And it's interesting because people like Bill Gates love the work of this guy. They just eat it up. Many other people have praised him, that he's the intellectual academic elite's favorite author, if you will. And the idea is, if all of these are fables, if you can't touch a human right, if the U.S. Constitution, if the Bill of Rights are just meaningless documents because they're just fictional stories, you can't dissect it physically and see a right, therefore they don't exist. This is laying the groundwork for a tyrannical, global, centralized government that doesn't have to take into account fables and stories, in his own word. I don't know what else you can say. It's just a fictional story, human rights. This is where they're telling us the quiet parts out loud. This was at a TED Talk. This wasn't, we got a secret audio recording or we have anonymous documents that were leaked to us. Can you believe he said this in private? He's saying this in public. He's saying it out loud. He's saying it out, he's saying it proud. Out loud and proud. Yuval Noah Harari wants everyone to see. They don't care anymore. This isn't a conspiracy. This is out in the open. They're doing what they want. They don't care what you think. They don't care you dissent. It goes back to last hour. I showed the clip of Justin Trudeau. This is the, actually, let's, I don't know, I hate to do this, but can we play that clip again? Clip five, just play half the clip if you can. You don't have to play the whole clip. This is Justin Trudeau, young leader of the World Economic Forum, follower of Yuval Noah Harari, who believes in rights are fictional. He can just, hey, truckers are protesting. What? They have no rights. That's fictional. Let's declare them domestic terrorists. But sir, that's never been done under the Canadian Emergencies Act. I'll be the first prime minister to ever invoke the darn Emergencies Act. Let's declare them domestic terrorists. Let's cancel their truck insurance. And let's call the banks and make sure the banks don't let them have access to their own money. This is how not the fictional public, but the real public that allegedly you represent react when they see you street level. Clip five from hour one, Justin Trudeau walking through the streets of Canada. Okay. That's what happens when you're trained by the World Economic Forum, praise the World Economic Forum, follow their policy and follow the policy advice of Yuval Noah Harari, who believes human rights are just a fictional story. That's what the public really thinks of you. And this is what has caused many revolutions in the past. Violent revolutions. And I'm not calling for that right now. I'm just telling you, this is the moment in history, 2024, where we are. And it's people like World Economic Forum, agenda contributor, Yuval Harari, who goes around saying human rights are fictional. We can't open a body and find them. They don't exist. And again, Bill Gates' favorite author. Okay. Speaking of Bill Gates, gee, where did his name come from? Bill Gates have requested the Danish government support the DTP vaccination of 161 million African children. And this is clip two, just to give you an idea of what Bill Gates is up to with his vaccine business. This is RFK Jr. laying waste to Bill Gates. Clip two.
The most popular vaccine in the world is the DTP vaccine, diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis. We got rid of it in this country because it was causing injuries, brain injuries, severe brain injuries or death to one in every 300 children. We used it in the 80s, and that's why there was all this litigation against vaccine companies that precipitated the passage of the Vaccine Act that then gave them immunity from liability. But in Europe, they don't use it. In America, they don't use it. But we give it to 161 million African children a year. Oh, Bill Gates asked the Danish government to support that program and said it saved 30 million lives. The Danish government said, show us the data. He wasn't able to. So they went to Africa and did their own studies. And they looked at 30 years of DTP data. And what they found shocked them all. They found that girls who got the DTP were dying at 10 times the rate of unvaccinated girls, but they were dying of things that nobody had ever associated with the vaccine. They were dying of diphtheria, of anemia, malaria, bilharzia, pulmonary disease, respiratory disease, and pneumonia. And nobody noticed for 30 years that it was the vaccinated girls and not the unvaccinated girls who were dying. And what had happened is these girls were not dying of diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis. The vaccine had protected them against those, but it had also ruined their immune systems, and they were unable to defend themselves against other just minor diseases that other kids who had hardy immune systems were able to fend off.
Once again, I keep flirting with the idea of supporting RFK Jr. What he's saying is amazing. It's not just, you know, oh, the vaccine works. Look, they didn't get diphtheria, pertussis. I always forget that last one, but diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus under the DDP. But look, all these other things happen. We've trashed the immune system. And that's what kept happening during COVID. People would claim, oh my gosh, I didn't get COVID. I'm not afraid of COVID. I'm worried about the vaccine, especially the medium and long-term effects. To hell with your vaccine. I'm now at the point now where my older kids had most of the vaccines, I believe almost all of them when they were young. My younger kids aren't getting them. I don't trust public health. I don't trust these vaccines anymore. I used to argue 10 years ago, I'd be arguing with a lot of the homeschool anti-vax, if you want to call them that, vaccine skeptic people. Like, what are you talking about? These things have been the greatest thing. I don't want to get into that discussion now. I'm just saying that the trust in public health has been collapsed, and rightly so. Well, and one of the reasons was that Bill Gates, and that was Bill Gates and the Danish government and all that, the vaccination. That's what RFK Jr. is talking about. Well, continuing again, this is going to turn into the RFK Jr. Unleashed with RFK Jr. because I keep showing so many clips of him, but he's the most articulate. You know, now that Vivek Ramaswamy isn't running for president anymore, RFK Jr. is the sole articulate voice on the issues for on my program here. So hopefully Donald Trump will pick Vivek Ramaswamy, and then we could go back to clips between RFK Jr. and Vivek Ramaswamy because they're so darn good. Okay. I love this clip. This is RFK Jr. explaining how Bill Gates uses the smokescreen of philanthropy to accrue vast personal profits. Now, he calls it philanthrocapitalism. In other words, the more money Bill Gates gives away, the richer he gets and the more his net worth grows. Gee, what a great way to be virtuous, isn't it? I'll give away money to this group over here, and I'll give money here, which will help my business model, and I get richer. Okay, clip three, RFK Jr. on Bill Gates and the smokescreen of his philanthropy.
The lockdowns really destroyed that whole illusion of globalization. But, you know, it was a money-making enterprise for Gates, and the vaccines are the same thing. He gives the money, gets tax deductions for giving the money to the WHO. Mm-hmm. He gains control of the WHO. The WHO pays for finances, the health ministries in virtually every country in Latin, in Africa. Mm. So he can then say, as a condition of getting that money, this is what WHO does. As a condition to get that money, you have to show that you vaccinated a certain percentage of your population. It's right. A milestone. And the vaccines that they're buying are owned by companies that Gates owns. Oh, it's this system where, you know, at the end, the punchline on almost all of his philanthropic projects are that he ends up making money. Oh, I don't look into his head and, you know, and speculate about why he thinks the way that he does, but he did the same thing with Microsoft. Microsoft was, it was a monopoly. It's to control every aspect, vertically integrate and control every aspect of the domain of the landscapes and, you know, be able to monetize philanthropy to make yourself richer.
It's the revenge of the nerds. Whatever girl rejected him in high school, it is on you.
I love that. The he's going to be essentially profiting off of his philanthropy. The more he gives away, the richer he gets, the more his net worth grows. What a great business model. And the reason no one can criticize him in corporate media, he funds the media, ABC, PBS, hundreds of millions of dollars, just pours it all out for the glowing media coverage. They're not going to say anything. The same thing pharmaceuticals do. That's why you don't hear any criticism of big pharma. They just buy it. The same thing is happening with climate. All the foundations giving money to the Associated Press and NPR and people, all these different new corporate news outlets. Reuters just take all this money, and they have a climate desk funded by billionaires with an ideological agenda. But hey, they're fair and objective and balanced news media. Okay. Well, on that same token, Scotland's power sector, talking about the green climate agenda, Scotland's power sector came under fire as it was exposed. Huge diesel generators were used to ensure dozens of giant wind turbines could function. So this is interesting because people think like, well, solar and wind, they don't need fossil fuels. Oh, yes, they do. Clip five.
Scotland's power sector is coming under fire after it was revealed that officials used massive diesel generators to ensure dozens of giant turbines on wind farms could function. According to the Sunday Mail, they were tipped off by a whistleblower who cited a number of environmental, health, and safety concerns, one of which was half a dozen diesel generators running for up to 6 hours a day to de-ice the wind turbines. Scottish Power said they were forced to hook up 71 windmills to the fossil fuel supply after a fault on their grid caused the system to fail to keep the turbines warm and working during the cold month of December. Other concerns from the whistleblower included thousands of liters of leaked oil from hydraulic units and technical faults that see turbines taking energy from the grid rather than producing energy.
And thus you have the story of green energy. It's incredible. I remember in the Michael Moore documentary, which was incredible, Planet of the Humans, I believe it was called. Yes, Planet of the Humans. Is against green energy, and Michael Moore got thrown out of the Planet of the Progressives. He was ejected after that film. In fact, it was banned on YouTube. They went after him. Climate activists like Michael Mann were attacking Michael Moore, the left-wing filmmaker. But he showed how a big demonstration of all this phony green energy, solar panels and windmill. He went, it was exactly like the scene in Wizard of Oz, where they find out that the wizard is the man behind the curtain and they peel the curtain back. He literally peeled the curtain back and showed diesel generators doing this big media event to show you the efficacy of the solar and wind panels. It was a great moment in his documentary. You're being defrauded on all this stuff. It takes all of the rare earth mining to make it, the transport, the lack of recyclability, the lack of energy they produce. They can't do a grid. They can only rely on the subsidies and the mandates and the banning of their competition. It's insane. This is in Mount Aso, Japan. Clip 4, the intrinsic natural beauty of mountains and forests and plants and animals are replaced by, cue the music, 200,000 hideous solar panels. Clip 4. And there you have it. That's the other thing. When I the Desert Storm Troopers, which I showed you last week, the documentary about the lanthanide mine, about the rare earth mining in the U.S. that was shut down and China took over because of our environmental concerns. And then you had lawsuits around that same time in the 1990s about solar panels going up in the desert, Mojave Desert in Nevada, maybe parts of California, suing them because of Endangered Species Act violations, because green energy is usually exempt. But there was a rare moment where the environmentalists were at, this was decades ago, actually concerned about the impact of solar panels on species. And you always see this, whether you're talking offshore wind and effect on whales, they're allowed to have more takings or killings of whales than are known to exist in the wild of certain whale species. That's how protected this is. No fossil fuel project could ever get away with that. This is the world in which we live right now. It's a dystopian hellscape of illogic. And as the WEF contributor Yuval Noah Harari would say, the fictional story is the one they're trying to impose upon us. And that's what I've cited you, Saul Freelander, the UCLA historian, who said that the Nazi regime of the 20th century used the bureaucracy to enforce magical beliefs. And that's exactly the mission of the World Economic Forum today, is to use the central planners, the administrative state, the unelected bureaucracy to enforce magical beliefs on the rest of us. And the magical beliefs range from believing a man can wake up one day and say he's a woman. Magical beliefs can believe that you can wave a magic wand and ban gas-powered cars and just electric vehicles will take over. Magical beliefs are that you can make agriculture comply with insane Soviet-style net zero compliance and will have plentiful food and be able to survive. Magical beliefs are destroying your energy sector and without expecting coming blackouts and absolute economic destruction. Magical beliefs are believing you can follow a Chinese tyrannical model and shut down your entire society for months on end, close churches, schools, stay-at-home orders, and stop a virus. Magical beliefs so that you could mandate a virus to vaccinate your way out of a pandemic, which didn't even qualify as a pandemic, and then force people to take an experimental emergency use authorization against their own guideline. That is the world in which we live. And that is the fable. That's the fictional story. Not that humans have rights and dignity, that no, you can't see them when you dissect them physically, but it doesn't make them any less real. You can't see the wind. Okay. All right. Sorry about all that. All right. Now let's come back. We have to take a break. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. We're going to come back with Colonel Rob Maness. I believe I said that right. He's a retired colonel, 32 years in the United States Air Force, combat veteran, 9/11 Pentagon survivor. He enlisted in the U.S. Marines. We're going to be able to talk to him about his America First policy. He's run for political office. We'll be right back with Unleashed right after these messages.
This is generally the view of people. Oh, we don't know much about Assange. Well, you should know, because whether you know it or not, he is fighting for you.
For your courage and leadership and tenacity in journalism and publishing.
Since 2010, Assange has been held in progressively narrower, darker, colder, and crueler spaces.
He has been detained since the 7th of December 2010 in one form or another.
And we are now here after years of imprisonment.
WikiLeaks is a non-state hostile intelligence service.
I think the man is a high-tech terrorist.
A high-tech terrorist.
A traitor, a treasonous.
He has to answer for what he has done.
Assange faces up to 175 years in prison for publishing classified documents exposing U.S. war crimes.
The U.S. government narrative about Julian is a complete fraud. It is a complete fraud from A to Z.
Julian took on the most powerful countries in the world, basically all of them.
We now have confirmed that there were plans to kidnap Julian here in the center of London, or even assassinate him.
No one who instigated that illegal and immoral war has been brought to justice. But the great truth teller sits behind bars.
If wars can be started by lies, peace can be started by truth.
Julian Assange is a hero.
What if everything we thought we knew about somebody was a lie? Would we be willing to go on a new journey of understanding? This is a story of deception, lies, bravery, and a man who risked everything to bring the truth to light.
Mr. Assange shows all the symptoms that are typical for a person that has been exposed to psychological torture over a prolonged period of time.
He looked at me intensely and said, "I hate to say this." He then hesitated, visibly troubled and searching for words. And then he finally said, "Please, save my life."
May future generations have the ability to speak without restraint. May our children and their children know truth and have access to information that leads to justice. Wherever Julian goes, free speech goes with him.
If there is a bird that is about to take flight, stretch her wings and rule the skies. May it be a peace dove and no longer a bald eagle.
If you think Assange is a traitor, he's a rapist, he's a narcissist, he's a hacker, I don't blame you because you have been deceived. And if you think you've not been deceived, that's normal because otherwise it wouldn't be deception.
Sometimes life can be overwhelming, and suicide may seem like the only way to relieve the pain. Beyond Now is an evidence-based app created by Beyond Blue to help you cope when suicidal thoughts start to appear. You can use it to create an easy-to-follow plan that is personal to you and includes steps like know your warning signs so you can act early, make your environment safe by removing harmful items, activities you can do or people you can be with to distract yourself from suicidal thoughts, reminders of things that make you feel strong. Some of these steps might be tough to fill out, and that's okay. It can be helpful to make or share your safety plan with a trusted friend, family member, or mental health professional. You might feel like you're alone, but help is available. If you're worried you can't stay safe, use the red telephone icon to call your emergency contacts. Download the free Beyond Now app today to create your personal safety plan.
Ladies and gentlemen, today's news talk.
News and information.
TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. All right, joining us now is Colonel Rob Maness, not of the Marines, but of the U.S. Air Force. My apologies, 32-year veteran. He is also the host of the Rob Maness Show, and he is also a former candidate for Senate. And he actually runs a foundation to support constitutional conservatives, and it's called Gator Pack. So thank you. Welcome to the program, Rob.
Thanks for having me on, Mark.
All right. Let's talk about, first of all, your military experience. So you were a 9/11 Pentagon survivor. Do you want to talk to us about that day and your experience with that? I remember because I was driving on 395. I was a reporter at the time, and I heard that the Pentagon was attacked, and I was probably about 5 miles away, but I was heading into Alexandria at the time. What was your experience like?
Well, it's interesting. I was on the phone with my wife, who was working in the Army Times publishing building down in Springfield, right on 395. So she was about 5 miles further south than you were, I think.
Okay.
At the time the building got hit, she actually told me, I was in the National Military Command Center, so the only evidence we had was a whoosh in the air conditioning system, and the smoke started coming in. She actually told me that she had seen a video of the airplane crash on the highway. Come to find out later, it actually hit the building and everything. So it was a pretty despicable day, devastating to have the world's most powerful military's headquarters be able to be struck by a non-government entity, a terrorist organization. They were quite good at their intelligence preparation of the battlefield, their target study, and then the execution of the operation, although they weren't successful except for in one way. That is just like the Japanese Empire did, and with Pearl Harbor, they awoke a sleeping giant and paid a heavy, heavy price for it. Although I'd like to see some of the military decisions made better so that we had a better outcome after Afghanistan.
Well, now you spent 32 years in the United States Air Force, and thank you, by the way, for that service. You're a combat vet. What wars did you serve in, and what did you learn as a result of that? As cliched as that sounds, forgive me for such a cliched question.
It's okay. Well, I had various jobs in each of the wars. The first war I was in, I wasn't actually in it, but I was an advisor to the British Army Explosive Ordnance Disposal Service and the Navy, the UK Navy Explosive Ordnance Disposal Service, and the Air Force, the Royal Air Force, during the Battle for the Falklands. We did that advice through what was then a rudimentary video link to the folks down on the ground in the Falklands from the UK itself. I was stationed over there. So I was a bomb disposal specialist, and they needed help with U.S. Armaments combined with British fusing that the Argentinians had been baking things up, so to speak. So we had to give them some professional advice on how to get those things safed that didn't go off properly when they were dropped or fired, and save some lives there. And then I learned to be a navigator on American jets and became a crew member on KC-135 tankers. So we did the air-to-air refueling in my first war, and there was in Panama, Operation Just Cause. I refueled the airborne command post that was orbiting over the battlefield the morning of the after the parachute drop. As a matter of fact, we were airborne during that parachute drop, refueling that airborne command post down by the Yucatan Peninsula and on down over Panama. I had the opportunity to fly in tankers again in Operation Desert Shield and Desert Storm, the operation to kick Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait after he invaded it. From there, we went into the Pentagon 9/11 thing. I became a squadron commander in B-1 bombers not too long after I left the Pentagon in the spring of 2002, after helping plan the war response into Afghanistan against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and help execute that. Then we went back to Texas, got requalified in the B-1 bomber, took command of a squadron and served as both the executive officer, the director of operations, second in command, and commander for about 30 months in the 9th Bomb Squadron at Dyess Air Force Base. And we deployed twice in support of combat operations in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Well, now you're also the chairman of this America First organization. And so the question is, when you look back on these battles which America has engaged in since 9/11 in particular, what is your evaluation of our foreign policy? You said we awoke the sleeping giant. Do you think the American response was appropriate? And I guess the other question is, how come Afghanistan took so long to get out? What should we have done different? Or do you think we handled it well after 9/11? We certainly didn't have any more terrorist attacks on domestic soil or anything major, of course, after that. But how did you think we handled that?
Well, from a military response perspective, we had to defend ourselves. And usually what happens when you do what I call opening the war box is you're going to get a response from whoever you open that on. And that's what happened to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And I think that was a justified response, post 2005, we had won. We defeated the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. There were friendly Afghanis that were ready to take over the government. In a very stupid move, in my opinion, the George W. Bush administration chose to embark on this idea of trying to remake Afghanistan into a liberal Western democracy in our own image. That's always been a bad idea. It was a terrible idea to try to do that with South Vietnam. It's a terrible idea to do that in Afghanistan. It was an even worse idea to take over Iraq in the middle of all that and try to do that. It was a terrible decision. It was totally unnecessary. As a matter of fact, we destabilized the entire Middle East and Southwest Asia. And as you can see now, it continues to be destabilized because we have refused to remove our troops from Syria and Iraq when we don't even need them there. So from an America First perspective, every decision we've made beyond going and defeating Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and not leaving in mid-2005. Mid-2005 is when my last combat deployment supporting Afghanistan ended. And in my debrief, my deputy and I told our boss, the Air Force two-star commander there in charge of Air Forces, that we had no strategy. It was time to leave. We had won. It's time to say we'd won, we've achieved victory. Let's redeploy home and give this country back to the people that it's rightfully theirs. We didn't do that. And we paid the consequences and paid the price for that and continue to pay the price today. Now we have commercial shipping in the Red Sea being attacked by Iranian backed Houthis out of Yemen. The Iranian militias have killed 3 Americans in Syria that don't need to be there. They should have been removed when we started leaving Iraq. And we should have never gone into Iraq in the first place. It'd be a lot more stable world, and the world wouldn't be on the brink of World War III. And I haven't even gotten to the decision to do what we're doing with Ukraine that we started doing in really the mid-2000s, too, again, under the George W. Bush administration. And, it's completely destabilized most of the world, and we're on the potential of a three-front World War III if something happens in the Pacific.
Well, let's go back to that. You know, as a military veteran, Air Force veteran, the question is, how in 2005 you saw it, you talked to people on the ground, there was no strategy. Why couldn't we pull out? Was that George W. Bush himself? Was it the Pentagon brass, as they say? Was it someone on the ground? I mean, why couldn't we just end that war at that point and come home, turn it over to the friendly Afghanis, as you say? Why does that not happen? It seems like, and that's where the phrase forever war comes in. I mean, because it lasted, until 2021, when we finally pulled out disastrously, 2021, when we finally pulled out disastrously. But why do you think we couldn't just pull out in 2005? What happens to the military? What happens to our government, the commander in chief? Why is it so hard for America to extricate itself from these situations?
Well, the American foreign policy apparatus on the state run by the State Department and the president, the commander in chief of the military and president of the United States, who is in command of all of that, made the conscious decision to rebuild Afghanistan as a liberal democracy modeled after the West, which was never going to work there. Alexander the Great even saw that and refused to invade the area and try to hold it for any length of time because he knew he would be defeated. He said, I believe that's where armies go to die. And we did not learn from that history, number one. And then we made this decision to continue to develop this into some form of democracy that would be amenable to us and look more like us, when that has never worked in Afghanistan. It's a tribal area. There are major tribes there, and the tribal leaders needed to have been able to come together after we had removed the Taliban and Al-Qaeda from power and kept them out of power on their own. And then the Afghani people would have supported that. They didn't support what we were doing. We spent billions of dollars building buildings, schools, fielding aircraft, air forces, training people, where at graduation ceremonies, a two-star Army general was shot and killed along with two other Americans that had done the training because they had infiltrated the graduating class of supposedly friendly Afghani forces. And that's because we made that decision. And once you make that decision, you go down that path to trying to establish a democracy in your own image in a place like Afghanistan, you start creating enemies from the young kids all the way up to the adults. And that's what's happened here. And we'll pay a price for a long time for that. And in the middle of all that, we went into Iraq. And once we won Iraq, we did the same thing. We made some terrible decisions with the Iraqi ground war and air war victory. One of those was making sure that those folks that were in the army that were of the Sunni Muslim tribe on the Saddam Hussein side of the population weren't allowed to serve anymore. So they lost their jobs. And guess what they became? They became first the insurgents, and then they created this thing called ISIS, which tried to establish a caliphate in northern Iraq, in northern Syria, that Donald Trump had to go in and defeat eventually. So very poor decision-making on our part. And then on the Ukraine thing, we have messed around with Ukraine through the State Department and the types of folks like Victoria Nuland since the mid-2000s. We've done two what are called color revolutions there, one in the mid-2000s and then one just before Putin went in and took Crimea back because we changed out leaders that were leaning towards Russia and put leaders in that are leaning toward America. And we finally wound up with Zelensky, who's doing the same thing. And Putin's like, you guys keep saying Ukraine's going into NATO. That's my red line. He said it many, many, many times. We refused to back off of that. After Joe Biden got elected, he refused to back off of that. And Putin said, okay, if you don't back off and acknowledge my real and historic over 1,000-year concerns about the territory of Ukraine and that it's important to Russia, that no Western European countries or Western countries be able to control it because it's our buffer zone, basically, between Russia and the rest of Europe and really the rest of the world, then I'm going to take action. And that's why we're where we're at today. And then we compounded the decisions and made them even worse by going all in. And our politicians saying stupid things like, well, we're going to take down Putin's armed forces on the cheap. Russia's going to be degraded and all that. We're going to put sanctions on them. And where are we at today? Well, where we're at today is that the Russian armed forces are making gains on the ground and they're conducting massive airstrikes every single night. They just started hitting what was left of the electrical grid and command and control nodes and anything that belongs to their secret service organization that Russia thinks conducted this mass killing of civilians in Moscow the other day. And they're continuing to do that. And Ukraine is openly saying, we don't have the air defenses. So as that continues to happen, Russia's GDP continues to climb because the sanctions have failed too. The United States and NATO and the West have made terrible decisions, and now they refuse to back down. This could have all been stopped even before Putin invaded the second time after Crimea by them coming to the table and at least getting a signature on the Istanbul agreements shortly after that. But what did we do? We sent the former UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson in to put the kibosh on the agreement. And so Zelensky had to back off. So now we are where we are. And the Ukrainians may lose Kiev. They may lose even Odessa and not have access to the Black Sea and have a little rump piece of territory over with the capital of Lviv over in the western side of the country up against the Polish border. And that's all that's going to be left because the United States and NATO refuse to acknowledge that Ukraine's border is not a vital national interest to us. Barack Obama said it during his administration. The bad part is he said that, and that the problem was it is a vital national interest to Russia. And Russia's acting on its vital national interest. It's what we should have expected they would do. And we are losing. We are losing badly. We are losing our credibility, and we have brought the world to the brink of nuclear destruction.
Well, is it too cynical to have the view, you know, the defense contractors, military industrial complex? We end Afghanistan in 2021 as at August, and within 5 months, we're in another major prolonged contract. Is it possible that, and of course, we had Mitch McConnell admit that the money that the Congress authorized for Ukraine government to help them never even left the United States. It went straight to the defense contractors. So the question is that too cynical of a view to think, okay, we can end Afghanistan now, but we need somewhere else to put all of our arms and supplies and money in? And is this a money laundering operation? Like, why did we do it? In other words, you know, RFK Jr. has been saying that for a while. That Ukraine is nothing more than a money laundering operations for essentially the military industrial complex. Do you share that view, or is that too cynical of a view of the defense contract industry and our leaders?
It's not too cynical of a view, but it's not the whole picture.
Sure.
Look, we've been funding the retirements of Ukrainian government workers. Think about that. We're paying the Social Security check payments to their retirees. Think about that. So that money's going to Ukraine. We're sending armaments that are going to Ukraine that end up on C-130s that are outbound. The only reason we know about that is because the C-130 crashed and the armaments were on board. And they were going somewhere into Southwest or further into Asia. Okay, so somebody is selling this stuff. So number one, so all the money, that's a lie. McConnell's a liar. All the money is not staying in the United States. Two, we've been giving them our war reserve ammunition and resources that we need to be able to deter the real adversary for the United States in the world that's capable of taking us down, and that's the Communist Chinese Party, Chinese Communist Party. Okay? They're in a massive buildup. Their combat navy is bigger than ours. This latest budget cuts 7 ships from our combat platforms while the Chinese are building 43 more. They're on a massive expansion program for their nuclear intercontinental ballistic missile system, which, oh, by the way, doesn't just sit in a concrete hole called a silo like ours do. All of ours do. They also have maneuverable tracked maneuver systems so they can move their missiles under the ground. And we never know where they're at. And they're building thousands more of those. So they're reaching parity with us. And our poor decision on Ukraine has pushed Russia into the arms of a waiting Chinese Communist Party. And now they have formal agreements on selling energy in the ruble through rubles and yuan, okay? Not dollars. That's destroying the petrodollar. And the American dollar is the reserve currency for the world. It's probably got a short life extension, but it's not going to last much longer because they've established BRICS, which is bringing other countries in to join them in not using the American dollar as the reserve currency. So it's not too cynical at all. And the problem with our military industrial complex is exactly what Dwight Eisenhower said. Even if it's not some overarching conspiracy or cabal that's all working together, it's all connected because of our large military. Okay, our armed forces are the largest and most complex in the world. They're still the best funded, the best equipped, and mostly the best manned with personnel. But that's not the issue. The issue is it is so vast, and we have such ties and tentacles to the military industrial complex, the corporations that build our weapons and command and control systems and supply our military, that it has a life of its own. And it loves the forever war policy. That's the reason why the forever war policy has got to end, so that we can put that system, that complex, back into the box and have the president of the United States and the American people have it back under control, because it is completely out of control. And unfortunately, I guess unfortunately, there isn't one cabal of corporate CEOs combined with generals and admirals and the president of the United States and National Security Council that controls it. The big problem is that none of them control it. And as long as we keep making decisions like we're making, it will continue to grow and get more powerful and become more out of control. And it'll be very difficult to correct the situation.
All right, we have to take a break. We're talking with retired United States Air Force Colonel Rob Maness. He's also the host of the Rob Maness Show on, I believe, Patriot TV. We'll be right back after these messages. I want to talk a little bit more about Ukraine and also the nation building concept, because that seems to be driving U.S. I want to talk about the origins of that and the sort of the insanity of that ideology. We'll be right back after these messages on TNT.
Not see it coming. It's prediabetes, and it captures one in three adults. You may not even know you have it, but you can escape. Take the 1-minute prediabetes risk test to know where you stand. With early diagnosis, you can change the outcome and prevent or delay type 2 diabetes. Be your own hero on smartphones everywhere at doihaveprediabetes.org.
I want to eat apples and bananas. I need to eat apples and bananas. Why can't I eat apples and bananas?
Support the Feeding America nationwide network of food banks to help provide meals to those in need. Join us at feedingamerica.org.
Unleashing the Beast, Mark Morano is unleashed on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. We're talking with retired Colonel of the United States Air Force, Rob Maness, host of the Rob Maness Show on Patriot TV. All right, just to finish up with Ukraine, one of the things we always heard is Putin is trying to rebuild the Soviet Union. Putin is worse than Hitler. If you don't agree with that, you're a Putin lover. And also you have the Senator Tim Scott famously said in the Republican debates, you know, we're going to degrade the Russian military. This is cheap. We're using Ukrainians to die for a lost cause. And we know it's a lost cause, but they're going to die. He didn't say it quite like this, but this is essentially what he was saying. They're going to die for us. And it's a cheap way to degrade the Russian military. Is he trying to rebuild the Soviet Union? And should we be using poor citizens in the Ukraine to degrade the Russian military for our benefit? Should that even be a huge goal of the United States, to degrade the Russian military?
Well, first of all, the facts just don't support that, Mark. If Putin, who is a retired KGB colonel, so you got to think about it the way he thinks. He thinks through that lens. I'm a retired Air Force colonel. I spent 30 plus years doing it. So I think through that experience. Okay. That's how my thinking is. So if he were really trying to recreate the Soviet Union, he would be having the Communist Party take over the Duma, all of the bureaucracy in the Russian government, and attempting to bring all of those Stan countries back into the fold with an iron fist. He would have rolled right in with tanks across the Ukraine all the way up to the Polish border and parked them there. He didn't do that. They went into Ukraine with a very small force, not more than 45,000 personnel. So, you know, the facts don't support that. There is no indication that he's trying to recreate the Soviet Union. But I'll tell you what he is trying to do. Russia has always been one of the world powers for over 1,000 years. And I believe that he firmly believes that his nation, the country of Russia, and if you watch the Tucker Carlson interview, he gives a master's class in Russian history along a timeline from his perspective. And he is trying to reestablish Russia as a major world power. He knows that he doesn't have the economics yet to make it a superpower like the Soviet Union was. And he really doesn't have a desire to do that because the Soviet Union collapsed due to its inability to control itself, either its territory, its states, governments, its military, its manufacturing. It all collapsed because it was a communist-based command manufacturing and an economic model that just doesn't work for very long once it becomes so large. So he's not trying to do that, but he is trying to reestablish Russia as a world power that's respected and that her interests, her vital interests especially, are respected by other nations in the world. And I think that's the point with him going back into Ukraine, is because the United States and the West and the rest of the so-called New World or liberal world order established after World War II, or the rules-based order, whatever you want to call it, didn't respect Russia's interest when we should have.
And then let's go back then to something earlier. This is we have about 2 minutes left. Mm-hmm. This idea of nation building, this has been labeled as neoconservative. The Bush administration was all in it. What are the origins of this? Does this go back to World War II? I mean, where did this come from? The idea that we could go anywhere in the world, if we can just convert them to a Western style democracy, we'll have peace and it'll spread like wildfire throughout the other regions. It'll put pressure. Where did this ideology come from?
I think in modern times, it really was created out of our experience in the Vietnam conflict. We experimented with South Vietnam, even though Ho Chi Minh has been said to be more like the George Washington of Vietnam than any other figure in human history would have been. But even though that was the case, we went to the South Vietnam part of the country and tried to create a Western liberal democracy and do what's called nation building. There were various names for the program, Johnson and Kennedy, Johnson and Nixon all tried different versions of this. And it was an utter failure, and it got almost 60,000 Americans killed. It got untold hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Vietnamese killed, created all the refugees that are now great American citizens. Although they're welcome and they do great things for America, I'm sure that their families would rather they had been able to survive in a free and prosperous Vietnam. So I think that's in modern times, that's where that comes from. Because if you go back too far before that, to like the Teddy Roosevelt era and those kind of things, locations in history, it's a little bit different. Like when we took over the Philippines, we were fighting and helping them fight an insurgency, and they essentially became almost a territory of the United States, which is different than what we tried to do in Vietnam and Afghanistan and Iraq. It's one of those, you break it, you buy it. But when America goes somewhere, we have never had the policy that we conquer and take and hold and keep territory. And that's what's been happening since post 9/11. We are leading with combat military force, not the threat of it, not the deterrence aspect of it, not the allied aspect of it, but we are leading with combat military force and imprinting ourselves on these nations that just are, their populations are never going to accept that. And that way, and what that means is you can build a nation all you want, but as long as you are trying to make it a conquered nation, which is what our basic policy is right now, it is never going to work. America is respected in the world at one time because we would go and help people if we needed to use military force, if they asked for it, or if we were attacked, we would do it, but then we would leave. That's what we're respected for, and that's what makes us stronger, and we need to return back to that foreign policy and national security policy, and that's an America First policy.
All right. Thank you very much. Retired United States Air Force Colonel Rob Maness. He's robmaness.com, host of the Rob Maness Show. Thank you for joining Unleashed today on TNT.
Thank you, Mark.
All right. And we will see you next time. Thank you for watching Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. Thanks a lot.